Thank you. Thanks to be here. So first, I wish to thank the organizers of this program because I think it's a good, very good and unique opportunity to mix people who are either more physicists or engineers related to engineers' problems to people who are really expert in geophysics and climate issues. So basically, coming here, I hope to learn a lot because I'm not very familiar with the topic of geophysics flow and climate modeling if things. So basically, I will try to talk a bit about my main interest, which is the problem of the transport and of heavy particles in the turbulent flow. And of course, as you know, this kind of thing is related to estimating the formation of rain in turbulent warm clouds. And so I will try to make a kind of overview of the things of recent things which were done on this topic. And so most of this work, of my work on these things, was done in collaboration with so some people in Rome. So Alessandra Lanotte is here, is participating to this program. And also with people in Lyon, so Raphaël Aguilar-Brandt, who was doing a PhD in physics after a PhD in philosophy on the ethic of global warming. So I had the opportunity to talk a bit with her about how the philosopher are perceiving the problem of global warming from a point of view of the ethic of science. And then Stefano Musacchio from Torino and Kostia Turitsin from the University of, who is now in a postdoc at the University of Chicago. So so my interest is a bit more general than the problem of clouds themselves. And so the problem of heavy particle suspensions in turbulent flows covers many areas. So starting from biology, like the problem of coexistence between several species of plankton, to the problem of planet formation in protoplanetary disks, or engineering problems, including the dispersion of sprays and combustion in some diesel engines, and the problem of course of pollutions, which is the pollutions due to heavy particles which are emitted by humans or by volcanoes in the atmosphere. So all these problems have a common thing, is the fact that one is considering particles which are not having an infinitesimally small size, but that have a finite size, and usually a mass density which is different from that of the fluid, so that they are not purely advected by the flow, but they have some inertia which is changing the way they are distributing in the flow and the kind of dynamical properties they may have. So the thing I will be considering mainly is the case of dispersed particles, which basically mean that I'm looking at the limits where the particles are sufficiently diluted so that they can be considered passive. So basically they have no feedback on the flow which is transporting them. And I'm also looking at a very limiting case, which is the case for which you can write actual equations for the particles. And basically it's the limit where the particles are considered rigid, spherical, and much smaller than the smallest active scale of the flow. So basically, one can then integrate the Navier-Stokes equation by neglecting the nonlinear terms in Navier-Stokes in the frame of the particles and obtain real equations. So this was done by many people, and the last persons which were involved on this topic were Maxey and Rayleigh, where they finally derived an equation for the particles, which is involving many terms. So there is an added mass term, a viscous friction term. So there are many forces which are acting on the particles. So the added mass, a viscous drag, and other terms, I don't remember exactly. This one is a part also of the drag, I guess. And this one is a history term, which depends on the past history of the particle dynamics. So this equation is very complicated. So I'm restricting myself even more to the case of particles which are very heavy. So in the limit where the particle density is much higher than the density of the fluid, of the surrounding fluid. And this is the case when one is considering, for instance, water droplets in air, where the mass density ratio is around 1,000. And so in that case, one can reduce a lot the equations, and the main effect which remains pertinent is the viscous drag with the fluid. Well, and basically one obtains the fact that one obtains a model where the particle acceleration is proportional to the velocity difference between the particles and the flow at the particular location. And so in the limits of passive particles, this fluid velocity is a prescribed field. Okay, yes?
What about gravitational
gravity, yes. So gravity should of course appear here, but the problem is that first I want to make something as systematic as I can. So I have I'm considering the most simple problem, and in some limits, in the limit of very small particle size, the gravity term is negligible compared to the viscous drag. And second thing is that there are some applications where gravity is not playing a role, which were basically my initial motivations. And in particular, it's the case of combustion in the diesel motors. Okay. So, but I will talk of particles without gravity. So the effect of gravity is adding a new parameter, which is the gravity response.
The inertia is much larger than gravity?
Inertia is much larger than gravity for small particles.
In diesel engine, it's possible.
In diesel engines, yes, because the velocities are high.
Oh yeah.
Yes. And for extremely small particles, the gravity is also negligible. So this model has the advantage, so as I was saying, to have a very few number of parameters. So first one is the Stokes number, which is measuring the effect of inertia, and which is the ratio between the particle response time which is appearing here, and the flow typical time scale. So in the case of a turbulent flow, it will be the Kolmogorov time scale, and of something which is connected to the outer flow, which is the Reynolds number. Okay, and so we will this velocity prescribed velocity field will be either a solution to Navier-Stokes, a turbulent solution to Navier-Stokes, or for some modeling, one can also consider a prescribed random velocity field to understand the qualitative effects on the particle dynamics. So the main observation of this equation is that even if the velocity field is incompressible, as in most applications, the particle's dynamics is dissipative, simply because it's a second order equation which has a non-vanishing right-hand divergence. And basically, this implies that the particles are going to not have a conservative dynamics, but a dissipative dynamics, and that they are going to concentrate on some bizarre set, which is an attractor. Okay, and this attractor is actually, since there is some time dependency here, this attractor is a dynamical object which will move with the dynamics of the particles. So the main idea in trying to characterize particle concentration, particle dynamical features, is to understand statistical properties of this random attractor. So the first thing on which I will talk about is the spatial clustering of particles. So this spatial clustering is something which was done for a long time. For instance, it was used for flow visualization by using bubbles in order to detect vortex filaments, for instance, because bubbles are concentrating in vortex filaments. But in the case of heavy particles, which is the opposite case of bubbles, what's happening is that the particles tend to be ejected from the eddies. So this is the qualitative understanding of such clustering, of what is called preferential concentration of the particles. And this clustering, the quantifying this clustering is particularly important for understanding, for instance, the rate at which particles will interact. Because if particles are not uniformly distributed, their interaction will be enhanced by the fact that there are fluctuations, there are strong inhomogeneities in their spatial distribution. Then it's also important to understand the fluctuations when one is considering a pollutant or something which is emitted in the atmosphere. So the mean things are well settled by a kind of mean field approach, which are telling basically that the pollutant is distributed with a Gaussian shape in space. But in order to quantify the fluctuations of such a pollutant, one really needs to understand the details of the spatial distribution of the particles. And then, of course, in many engineering applications, it's quite important to understand how the particles' dynamics is itself affecting the flow. And of course, if the particles are forming clusters, the modeling, the feedback of the particle will be very different than if they were uniformly distributed. So this is an image which is coming from a direct numerical simulation of Navier-Stokes, where particles were seeded, so passive particles were seeded. And this is what one observed at a given snapshot, for a given snapshot, in a slice of width, which is around 2-3 etas, three times the Kolmogorov scale. And one see that even, so this is in that case, the particle response time is smaller than the Kolmogorov time scale. And one can see that in that case, it's possible to observe fluctuations in the particle distributions, which are extending up to the inertial range. So that the inhomogeneities are not only at those scales where the particle's inertia is the most important, but are affecting all scales. And when one is zooming on a small element, where in order to detect what's happening at scales of the order of etas, then one observe again inhomogeneities at such scales. But this time, the kind of inhomogeneities is very different, because basically, so it's a bit hard to see from this picture, but one can observe that the particles seems to be concentrated on kind of filaments, okay, which are basically a signature of this strange attractor, which is evolving with the particles. Well, basically, you all have a picture of how a strange attractor is looking like. It's looking like a folding of unstable manifolds, on which you have again fractal distribution on lines, basically. And basically, it's the typical picture of dissipative dynamical systems of a combination of folding and stretching.
You would describe this as the slinging effect?
The sling effect is connected to velocities, difference of velocities between particles. Here, I'm just concentrating on what's happening in the spatial distribution, so it's more how to quantify preferential concentration of the particles. So we talk later about velocity statistics. Okay, so the sling effect is the fact that particles can arrive at the same position with very different velocities. And here, there is no consideration about velocities.
This is a three-dimensional simulation?
So it's a three-dimensional simulation.
What's the Reynolds number?
So the Reynolds, the Taylor-based Reynolds number is around 200, so it's 180.
What's the Stokes number?
So the Stokes number for this snapshot is around 1.
Yes. But of course, one snapshot is not enough to understand where we
are. Of course, one has to make statistics. This is just a qualitative thing. So that basically the idea from looking like this at the distribution is that one can try to think about two kind of mechanism which are explaining the fact that you have particle clustering. One which is related to the motion of the flow itself, and which spans all the scales of the turbulent flow, and which is basically the fact that you have voids appearing and places where here like this where the particles are more concentrated. So this might be linked to the structure of the flow. And then if you zoom, you have at small scales, a fractal structure of the particle distribution. So basically, so this is just to light up this mechanism for inhomogeneities in the particle distribution. And basically, there is a competition and balance between several effects. So qualitatively, from a qualitative point of view, so as I was saying, there is a dissipative dynamics, so that the particles are concentrating on something on an irregular set, which is a fractal or multifractal. And then when one is looking, so this, of course, this irregular set is living in the full phase space of the particle dynamics. So since the particles dynamics since the particles are obeying a Newton equation, the phase space is position velocities. So that this fractal set is living in this position velocity space space. But one, when one is looking at the particle distribution, one has to project the sets somehow on the physical positions, and one obtains the projection of a multifractal set. And then the small scale properties are related to the statistical properties of this projection. And then when one is looking at larger scale, the main effects which is leading to inhomogeneities in the particle distribution is the fact that particles, since they are heavier than the fluid, tends to be ejected by inertial effect from rotating regions and to concentrate in places where there is less rotation and more laminar flow somehow, because less eddies. And so the idea is that there is a balance between these two effects, and one has to quantify which one is important and which one is relevant to explain such and such qualitative behavior in the particle distribution. So if one is willing to make a theory, it's very hard to account for these two effects at the same time. And so the basically, this to try to understand in a more quantitative point of view what's happening, one needs to disentangle these two effects and to consider models where one or the other effect is isolated. And for instance, if one is willing to understand only what's happening due to the multifractal fact that the particles are on a fractal, one needs to consider flows which are having no structure. So for instance, a delta correlated flow, where basically the only effect is this dissipative dynamics and the fact that you have a clustering on a strange set.
It's okay. The second mechanism is clear and understandable, even from the equations. What about the first mechanism? Is it possible to understand?
Yes. So basically, it's
equations.
So basically, from the basic equations, you see that the particle dynamics is dissipative. So that if you take any phase space volume in the position velocity phase space, this volume is shrinked to zero at long times. So that all the particles in this phase space are concentrating on something which has a zero volume, an attractor. Okay, so this is just you can just see it by looking at the equation. And you know that the if you consider phase space volume, so position velocity phase space volume, which is evolved by this equation, the rate at which this volume is contracted is given by the divergence of the right hand side. Okay, so you have to consider it. So basically, you have to write it as a first order system. Okay, so V dot is minus 1 over tau V minus U. Okay, and the rate at which things are contracted in this XV phase space, okay, is exactly the divergence of this right hand side. So it's derivative of this with respect to X plus derivative of this with respect to V. And the fact that there is this dissipative term, this drag term, is telling you that the rate at which things are contracted is always minus D, the space dimension, divided by the response time. Okay, so that the dynamics is really dissipative, and that you are concentrating on a set in XV space which has a zero volume.
Does the equation include the two effects already?
So this equation, yes. I mean, as soon as U is a non-trivial velocity field like the solution of Navier-Stokes, it has eddies, and the solution to this equation is ejected from an eddy. And then this equation has a dissipative, implies a dissipative dynamics. So
you get the ejection. You can have that for, say, a steady rotating vortex, or does it have to be the ejection?
So basically, the ejection time is of the order of the response time of the particles, so that the lifetime of the eddies has to be larger than this ejection time.
So if you had a steady vortex, you get the solution would be.
If you have a steady vortex, the solution will be it's an extreme case where all the particles are ejected after some time.
And also, is it are we really talking about vorticity, or does it have to, could you just have like, you know, K over R kind of vortex, which is, no, does the flow field have to have vorticity in it too?
No,
it just has to
have a gradient, which is non-trivial. So just to move on, so I will, yes, just to, for people who are interested in, so this is a kind of a summary of the direct numerical simulations result I will present. So basically it's a pseudo-spectral code, so which basically means that one is considering a homogeneous isotropic turbulence, which might be a bit far from reality, but anyway, the there is no hyper viscosity, everything is resolved in the proper way in the dissipative range, and then the spatial resolutions which are considered are three, so that we have access to three different Reynolds number to see how the Reynolds number is affecting the particular properties. Then so basically the something which might be of interest is just to stress that we have a lot of particles, so we have for instance for the largest resolution we have 7 million of particles for a given Stokes, and then we have 16 different Stokes to try to sample the maximum things, and these things are stored every 10 times the Stokes time, the Kolmogorov time, and then for a smaller sample of particles we have a much higher resolution in the storing, a much higher frequency in the storing, such that we are able to reconstruct particle trajectories. Okay, and all this data is available on this database, which was created by Federico Toschi, and which is in the Italian Computer Center in Bologna, and it's freely accessible. I can give you the
Can you tell how the number of particles related to resolution, you change your resolution, you put too many particles, it's like a fluid?
So basically the particles are passive. So the idea is to take a lot of particles to increase statistics.
But you still describe for each particle the right equation.
Yes.
But if you have too many particles, maybe you have to write field of particles, like passive scale.
Yes. So the problem is that since the dynamics is in phase space, one would have to because you don't have a field of particle velocities. At a given point, so yes, it will be a kinetic thing, and you will need to integrate a distribution of particles in phase space, position velocities. So in 3D, it will be a six-dimensional phase space, and there you cannot do numerics with a 512 cube resolution. It's beyond the possibility. So the best way is to track individual particles, and the fact that we have, so there is no feedback on the flow, so the flow dynamics does not depend on the number of particles. So that at the end the idea is to have a lot of particles just to increase the statistics. That's all.
You drop diffusion in this equation.
Yes.
Are you sure it's a good idea?
So basically, the diffusion will be there is some numerical diffusion, but diffusion will be very small compared to inertia.
No, but if you start to study this in Henrich approximation, diffusion means you got Laplacian. Laplacian is another type of equation.
Yes.
So maybe it's crucial step. Maybe.
Yeah, but anyway, so the there are several free parameters. And then depending, so basically there are two. In the particle dynamics, there are two parameters. One is the size, and the other one is the mass density. The mass density ratio with respect to the fluid. So depending on where you're choosing these two parameters, you can have diffusion important, inertia important, and basically no inertia but just advection by the flow, etc. So basically this two parameter space is tunable in such a way that you have different regimes. So the regime I'm considering is the one where the inertia is the most important effect, and that's why I'm neglecting all the other things.
The particles interact with each other?
No, there is no particle to particle. No, there is no. So basically it's the limit of very dilute suspensions where there is no feedback on the flow and no particle-to-particle interactions. So maybe we can discuss about the importance of diffusion. So basically, the first thing one can try to do is to play with the usual tools of dissipative dynamical systems in order to quantify what's happening in the dissipative range. So basically, the idea is to measure fractal dimensions. So for instance, the thing which is important when one is looking at binary interactions or particle-to-particle things is to look at what is the probability of having two particles at a very close distance. Okay, and what is telling us the theory of dissipative dynamical systems is that the thing is such that this probability of having two particles, so the probability of having two particles at a distance less than a given r, has a power law behavior which is non-trivial, okay, and which is scaling with the correlation dimension, with what is called the correlation dimension, and which in most settings is less than the space dimension. Okay. So this is a picture of what's happening when one is measuring, estimating from this 2-point probability the correlation dimension, and one can observe that it has a non-trivial dependence on the Stokes number, on the response time of the particle, and that it does not, it's not affected up to the error bars of our measurement by the value of the Reynolds number as soon as this Reynolds number is sufficiently large. Okay, so there is no direct observation of the effect of flow intermittency on the particle, on the 2-point particle distribution. And then the thing which was known for a long time is that there is a maximum of response of the particle to the flow, which is appearing for Stokes number of the order of unities, which is basically when the particle response time is of the order of the Kolmogorov timescale. Okay, so there is nothing very new in this thing. So basically, at small Stokes, one is recovering a uniform distribution, so that the fractal dimension is tending to the space dimension, which is 3, and at large Stokes number, one is again going to the uniform distribution, simply because when the particle response time is very long, two particles which are very close have a very different history because they have a very long time to react to the flow disturbance, and basically they arrive together completely uncorrelated one to the other, so that at the end the distribution is again uniform at large Stokes number. So when one is looking at more than 2-point distribution, so one is trying to sample the fractal spectrum of the attractor, one observed that for different moments of the distance between particles, one has different power laws, which basically mean that the particle distribution is multifractal and not fractal. Okay. So basically the thing. The main message is that the small-scale clustering is not very affected by the value of the Stokes of the Reynolds number and has a kind of universal shape as a function of Stokes. So, in order to try to quantify this shape, there were several analytic attempts, which were basically, as I was saying before, in random flows where one is neglecting the structures of the flow, when one is just concentrating on what's happening from a purely dynamical point of view. And basically, what was chosen as a kind of framework for these studies is the case of particles which are transported by the smooth limit of crack and flow. So let me remember you that what... So crack and flow was introduced by Bob Cracknan at the end of the 60s, in 69, as a model for passive transport. And basically, the idea was to consider a passive scalar, which is transported by a flow which has no time correlation, but a given spatial correlation with a given power, which is adjusted to mimic the turbulent case. Okay. And so the smooth case of this crack and flow is the case when this power is such that the flow is differentiable in space, but it's delta correlated in time. Okay, So this would mimic somehow what's happening inside the dissipative range of turbulent flow. And so when one is measuring numerically how the correlation dimensions, so this is the two-dimensional case, when how the correlation dimension of the particle distribution is behaving as a function of the Stokes number, one is obtaining something which is very similar to the what's observed in Navier-Stokes, where basically one is departing from the uniform distribution. There is a minimum which is for a given value of the order of unity. So here it's 10⁻⁻, it's 0.07. So it's a fixed value. It's not something there is no small parameter that will make it asymptotic. And then after some point, the correlation dimension of the particle in phase space is becoming above, is larger than the dimension of the physical space, so that when one is projecting this phase space distribution, one sees something which is space filling. Okay, and so that it's after some point it's saturating to the space dimension. So, but the main trouble is that even in this very restricting case of smooth cracking and flow, there is no analytical form for the dependence of this correlation dimension as a function of the Stokes number. So there were several attempts, and basically the only case which is solved is the one-dimensional case, so which is very restricting because the flow is infinitely compressible because it's potential, okay, and so this was some work which was initiated by Peter Barg, which was pursued by Wilkinson and Melig, and the solved case was recently done by Falkovich and Grisha and collaborators, and basically it's a nice problem because there is a map between this problem and the problem of Anderson localization, so there is some link with non-trivial statistical physics. And so the other analytic attempts were in the limit, where a kind of expansion as a function of the Stokes number, so for very small perturbation times, response time of the particles, where basically to leading order one can consider that the particles are advected by a synthetic compressible flow. Okay? And this is the main trouble is that it's a singular limit, so that one needs to control the convergence, and at the end one obtains mostly non-analytic form, so that expansion are very hard to do. So there are ways to tackle such singular limits, like stochastic averaging, which are basically which are coming, I guess, from Papanikolaou in Stanford. And basically the such techniques lead to a first order approximation of this correlation dimension, but as you know, there is no strict result on the convergence of such techniques for tackling singular limits. So the main trouble is that there is another trouble below this, the fact that that one is tackling singular limit things, is the fact that when the only settings where delta correlation in times is valid to true problems, realistic problems, is when the particle response time is much larger than the Fried typical time scale, because basically in that case the particle will kind of average the flow motion over long times, and then one can use central limit theorems to say that to leading order what is observed is like a delta correlated flow, okay, because you have several basically turnover times of the flow along a relevant time scale of the particle, and these analytic results are in the opposite limit when the Stokes number is very small, so that they are not physical.
This result is linear in Stokes. It's not for Krackmann model. It's for Krackmann model.
Yes.
So it's Krackmann model, but a small Stokes.
Yes. So which is the non-physical limit?
It's published in.
Yes. It, where?
Where?
In Physica D. So basically, a nice thing which is stemming from the fact that one is considering such a model flow like a Kraken flow is the fact that there is a change of variable if you look at the dynamics of particles, which is such that one is obtaining is changing the fact that one has a multiplicative noise which is hidden in the fluid velocity to an additive noise. And basically the idea is just to look at two particle motion and to rewrite the dynamics in terms of longitudinal velocity difference between the particles and a component which is transversal. Okay, and so I don't want to enter too much into these details, but the at the end when using this change of variables, one obtains, for instance, in two dimensions, which is the case here, two coupled stochastic differential equations, which are which are describing the evolution of this longitudinal and transverse velocity differences, which are involving a nonlinear drift, okay, but an additive noise. Okay.
What does C here?
C is a combination of the constants in front of the correlation in the Kraken model, so what is usually called D1, and of the particle response time. Okay, so it's something which depends on the parameters of your flow and of your particle dynamics. And so so basically this leads to a nice interpretation of what's happening to particle dynamics. So this sigma is somehow sigma is not only it's a rescaled velocity difference. So sigma 1 is the longitudinal velocity difference. Okay, so basically longitudinal velocity difference is the velocity difference between particles projected on the separation, okay, divided by the distance between the particles. So it's a kind of velocity gradient of the particles, of a possible particle velocity field if it existed, but it's not existing. Okay, so it's a kind of ad hoc gradient of the particle velocities. And so the nice thing is that because of the simple form quadratic nonlinearities of the drift, there is a nice interpretation of what's happening to the particle dynamics. And so if one is looking at a typical trajectory in this sigma 1, sigma 2 phase space, one observes that the trajectory is spending a lot of time close to a stable fixed point, which is sigma 1 equal to sigma 2 equal to 0, okay, which is where the drift is vanishing and it's a stable point. And then you're adding to the top of it some diffusion. And if the diffusion is sufficiently large, the particle arrives to another fixed point, which is this time unstable, okay, which corresponds in this thing, sigma 1 equal to minus 1 over tau and sigma 2 equal to 0. And when it's arriving in the neighborhood of this unstable point, the particle is pushed away to negative sigma 1, okay, to negative velocity differences between the particles. So the two particles are moving one to the other, okay. And in sigma 1, sigma 2, this corresponds to a loop in this plane. And because of these loops, one can infer some statistical properties of the PDF of velocity differences between the particles. And these loops are related to the caustics, which are appearing in the particle distribution, which are corresponding, as you were saying, to the slings, okay, where particles are arriving at the same position with different velocities.
I would like to stress that sigma 1 can be negative, but sigma 2, as I understand,
sigma 2 is
positive. Yes. Is it, compared with this equation, is it really just positive sigma 2?
No, one has to. So basically, the sign of sigma 2 is not affecting the dynamics of sigma 1 because it's just a square. Okay?
No, I speak about positive.
So basically, these equations are symmetric. The drift part is symmetric if you replace sigma 2 by minus sigma 2. So that either you can consider that the dynamics is taking place on the whole thing, or you can put a reflective Mondalri condition at sigma 2 equal to 0.
You cut negative sigma 2.
Yes, you just put a reflective. I mean, both are equivalent from a Fokker-Planck point of view.
Except noise breaks your symmetry.
Yes. No, the noise, yes, but...
Eta 2 breaks your symmetry.
Yes, yes, yes.
So there's no sigma 2 minus sigma 2 symmetry.
Okay, so in two dimensions. The right way to do it is, so in two dimensions, this quantity without the absolute value is a fixed number. It's not a vector, it's a fixed number, because it's perpendicular to the plane, okay? And then what you can do is that you can write an equation without the absolute values, okay? And what you obtain is that an equation which does not depend on the sign. So when you write the Fokker-Planck equation, this means that you can either impose that look at something where you're living on the full sigma 2 positive and negative plane, or that you have a reflective boundary condition because of the symmetry. Now, if you go to three dimensions, it's a bit more complicated. One has now to take the norm of the vector.
I'm not convinced. Yeah. Since you keep eta 2, the last term,
yes,
in second equation,
yes,
I don't see why system is symmetric.
No, I mean, if you... Okay, so... It will be symmetric in the for the Fokker-Planck equation. So the diffusion term is giving a second order derivative with respect to sigma 2. And if you make sigma 2 to minus sigma 2, this term is not changed.
When you switch to Fokker-Planck, okay, I have to adjust.
Yes. Okay. So basically, no, the two formulations are equivalent and giving the same stationary distribution. So either considering the dynamics on the full plane or just considering it on sigma 2 positive and putting a reflective boundary condition at sigma 2 equal to 0. If you want, we can discuss. Yes, but anyway, the important dynamics is the one with sigma 1, which is telling you if where you are compared to your fixed points, and this one is not affected by the sign of sigma 2. Anyway, if you want, we can discuss in more detail. So basically, now the question is that once one has done this, the temptation is to try to extend it to the case when model flow, this Kraken model flow, is not differentiable, but has some scaling properties. And then the something that is directly stemming from the equations of motion of particles is that at the end, one has to consider not... So basically, the Stokes number is not anymore the only parameter, but the scale is also a parameter, because the fact that you are imposing a given time scale, like the particle response time, is telling you in a self-similar flow that you are breaking the self-similarity of the dynamics, and that you will have a preferential thing at the time scale which is corresponding to this particle response time. Okay, and the way to tackle this issue is to consider a scale-dependent Stokes number, okay, which depends basically on the scale at which you're observing your particle distribution, and so it's obtained just by normal by balancing the Stokes time by the usual time scale associated to a given length scale, okay, and then once this is observed in the equation of motion, what you can say is that basically, considering a given particle response time and a given scale of observation is equivalent to considering another particle response time and a different scale of observation, which are such that the local Stokes number is the same. Okay, basically, the particle distribution depends only on this local Stokes number. Okay, so this is just true as soon as you are far away from the boundaries of your system, okay, when you are at sufficiently small scales. And so this is shown, I mean, illustrated on this picture, where one is measuring a kind of scale-dependent correlation dimension. So basically, one is not taking any limit when r goes to zero, but is defining a d2 which depends on r, which is just the ratio between the log of this probability divided by the log of r. So it's a kind of local dimension. Okay? And basically, this thing should depend both on the scale and on the particle response time. And by doing this proper combination, okay, so basically by measuring for various value of the flow safe similarity exponent, what's happening, so by measuring this local dimension as a function of this local Stokes, one observes that the things are indeed collapsing and that your particle distribution, so the local dimension of this particle distribution, depends only on this local Stokes number. Moreover, what is interesting is that the shape on how this local dimension is depending on the Stokes number is very similar to what is observed in the smooth case, in the sense that, of course, it's going to the space dimension when Stokes is small. It's going again to the space dimension when Stokes is large. And in between the two, there is a minimum of the dimension, the maximum of clustering, which is happening for a fixed value of the Stokes number.
How is it possible to determine here the size of the cluster of particles?
So there is no size, it's fractal. So, I mean, as soon as you are looking at scales which are much smaller than the your domain size, you just see a fractal behavior, basically. So it's in the case of rough flows, of flows which are not differentiable, you are losing this fractality or multifractality, and what's happening is that when basically the correlation dimension is trivially the dimension of the space, because if you go to very small scale, it's like if you were increasing a lot the inertia. Okay, because the time scale associated to a very small scale will be very small, and so that at the end the locally it will be like if you were having an infinite inertia. So the true correlation dimension is always the space dimension. However, if you look at finite size, finite scale, then you can define this local correlation dimension, which is a non-trivial function of the Stokes number, of this local Stokes number, but a function which is very similar to what's happening in the smooth case. And so basically, I think that's all what I wanted to say about the Kraken model. And now let's turn to what's happening in the true flow and how to relate this inertial range clustering due to dissipative dynamics to what's happening in the true flow. Well, again, now one has structures and the effect might be very different. And so the first thing, for instance, is if one is looking at how the particle distribution is correlating with the flow structures, there is something which is very significant is the acceleration field of the fluid itself. Okay? So here what is represented is again a slice in a turbulent flow of the modulus of the acceleration of the fluid. Okay, so that the white things, the white spots correspond to very strong acceleration and the dark one are very low accelerations. And when one is looking at the same time, same slice at the particle distribution, one observes that there are very strong correlations with the acceleration field. So I mean maybe it would be more relevant if all these figures were superimposed, but if you look, for instance, at this very strong acceleration, which corresponds to a cut of a vortex filament, okay, so you have so basically acceleration is strong when you have a very strong rotation, and so you see that this strong acceleration thing is leading to an empty area in all the particle fields. And whose extension depends, of course, on the particle response time or the Stokes number.
The acceleration is, I mean, that could result in some ways It's also acceleration. So this is centrifugal acceleration. If you use the vortex filament, then it's the centrifugal acceleration, right?
Yes. But at the end, you can understand it in a very easy way by looking at the. So let me rewrite the equation for the motion of a particle. So minus one x dot minus u. Okay, so if basically you look at the asymptotic of small particle response time, okay, so this thing is becoming very small. This acceleration is you expect it to remain finite, and so you want this thing to vanish, okay? And so basically, to leading order, you have x dot equal to u. But then, if you look at the second order correction, what you have is that this thing will be of the order of the acceleration of the fluid, okay? And so that at the end, if you write it, what you have is that you have x dot is u plus a correction which depends on tau, and which is just the acceleration of the fluid at the position of the particle. Okay, so when this guy is small, the particles are almost following the flow. And basically, when the acceleration is small, so for instance, in this black area, basically, you have something which resembles a lot a uniform distribution, at large scales, of course. But as soon as acceleration is strong, inertia is becoming important, and the particle thing is deviating from the velocity. So of course, then you can say that this in a turbulent flow is of the order of the pressure gradient. Okay, and then you know that the pressure, you know the orientation of the pressure gradient in a vortex filament, and you can just say that. This thing will make you go out from vortex filaments simply to leading order. So the next thing is to say, okay, so let me try to quantify how this particle distributes inside the inertia range. So the easiest way to do it is to cut my domain in small cubes of sizes which are inside above the Kolmogorov scale, and to look how are distributed, what is the mass of particles inside these cubes. So basically, I'm looking at the PDF of this coarse grain mass distribution, and so here it's a density because it's just divided by the size of cube of my box, and I look how it's behaving for different Stokes number, different values of the particle response time. So these are the different colors here. So the first thing is that I guess that the size at which the coarse grain was done is around 32 times the Kolmogorov scale. Okay, so it's well inside the inertia range. So the first observation is that even for the smallest value of the Stokes of the simulation, which was around 0.1, I have very strong deviations from a uniform distribution, from a Poisson distribution. And this, you can see that the green and the dashed line are very different. And then there is a kind of universal shape for these things, is that at small values of the mass or of the density, I have a power law tail with a power which depends on the Stokes number. And then at the large value of mass, the tail is going down faster than exponential, and actually it's something like what is shown, it's not shown on this picture, but it's something like an exponential of the density times the log of density with a constant. Okay, so it's faster than exponential, but it's not a stretch exponential. And so the thing is to say, okay, so now I'm observing this as a function of Stokes. Let me observe what's happening as a function of scale. And when I'm decreasing Stokes, is exactly the same as increasing scale. That if I go to higher and higher scale for a fixed Stokes, I'm decreasing the effect of inertia, okay? Because the particle, the flow turnover time is becoming larger and larger, so that the effect of the flow on the particles is stronger and stronger. And then I'm going more and more to a uniform distribution. And so the idea is to say, okay, I observe the rescaling for the particles in this similar random flow. Can I observe rescaling by a proper combination of Stokes' time and of the land scale and of my observation to obtain something which depends only on a kind of local Stokes number. And the first idea is to say, OK, I just need to take my particle response time and to rescale it by the turnover time of a given scale. But the thing is that when one is doing this, there is no basically that this local Stokes number, which is obtained by rescaling the particle response time by the turnover time given, for instance, by chromatograph theory, is not relevant. It's not the right thing that is rescaling all the PDF. And so the idea is, what is what is the relevant time scale of particle concentration? So if it's not the turnover time, how can I define it? And basically, the idea is to consider the limit of small Stokes number, of small Stokes times. Well, basically, I know that this approximation holds. And I say, OK, if I want to have the same discrepancy with respect to the free motion, what do I need to change? I need to change the acceleration here, OK? So that the right time scale is not given just by the turnover time scale, but is given by the structure of the acceleration field. So what is the acceleration field? It's something which is exactly like pressure. And so when one is looking at how these discrepancies are affecting, for instance, the time scale at which a blob of particles of a given size inside the inertial range is contracted or not, basically one has to integrate this guy over a blob of size R. And one, what obtains at the end, so not this one, but the divergence of this one, what one obtains is something which is relating the time scale of at which particles are distribution is differing from the one of the fluid with the pressure increments. Okay? And so then the problem is that the question of the scaling of pressure in the turbulent flow is a still debated issue, and there is no clear understanding of how things are behaving. And so I don't want to enter the details of this question of pressure scaling, but at the end, if one is just applying a dimensional analysis, so a kind of just chromatograph thing, one obtains a scaling of pressure which is of the order of R to the power 2/3. But the thing we are observing in our numerical simulation is different. Okay, it's not R to the power 2/3, but more R to the power 1/3. And this has some hand-waving explanation, which is saying that the main contribution to the scaling of pressure is not coming from the square of the increments, but from the term which is involving the sweeping. So basically, the fact that leading order, you are transported by the mean flow. And so once one is observing this, then one can say that the relevant way to rescale the particle distribution is by non-dimensionalizing the particle response time by something which is proportional to R to the power 5/3 instead of the 2/3 which were coming from the local Stokes number.
But these Reynolds numbers, I don't think any of these exponents are relevant
anyway. Yeah, no, but so basically if you compare...
This
picture is not very nice because it's very squeezed like this. But you see that clearly that if you look at the place where you seem to have a k to the minus 5/3, so here R lambda is 200, so you start to see some scaling. Of course, it's not. Yes. So I don't want to enter this thing. So basically, of course, for infinite Reynolds number, one expect this. For infinite Reynolds number, one expect to see the scaling of pressure given by chromatograph, of course. So this might be due to a finite Reynolds effect.
And also, in principle, if you would like to apply this to atmospheric flow, you have to take into account that the Stokes number equals 1 corresponds to particles, size particles of the order of 50 microns. For such size, you have to take into account gravity.
You have to take into account gravity? Yes, of course. Yes, yes. Yes, of course. Of course.
Well, it depends on turbulence, and it stops to be order on 20. It depends how strong the turbulence is. All around, so two orders of magnitude interval, the different types of colors. Yeah, but gravity generally, I mean, after 20 miles.
Yes, of course. Yes, of course, there should be gravity effects. No, but anyway, the idea.
It won't change anything qualitatively here.
It will change, mean that there will be different regimes.
And so you have to take into account the anisotropy.
Yeah, but then at very large gravity,
droplets would be falling so fast that they would be actually averaging over a certain direction. Mm-hmm. And then from there, you point the field that they would see would be a two-dimensional field, but it would be short correlated because it fell so fast. And this model of two-dimensional short correlated field would be exact in the limit of very heavy droplets. So in a sense, I mean, for very heavy droplets, you just back to a simpler problem, which is two-dimensional isotropic short correlated.
So anyway, so the message is not about the scaling of pressure. It's just that the relevant time scale, if you are considering this problem, is not given by the stupid Stokes, local Stokes that you obtain by dimensional arguments. That you have to take into account the thing which is entering is the pressure increment and not simply the turnover time. So just so basically, once one has made this observation, then one can collapse for different Stokes and different scales the PDF of mass. Okay. The collapse is pretty good, and then so basically then what I wanted to finish with is just to talk a bit about how to explain and what kind of models you need in order to obtain the same kind of distribution as the one you're observing in the Nash range, so basically with a power law tail at small values of mass and something which is faster than exponential at large mass. And basically, the thing is the idea was to consider a very simple model where the only thing you have is ejection of particles from some given places in space. So you just cut your domain in boxes. In each box, you put a 0 or 1. If it's 1, it's ejecting mass. If it's 0, it's accepting mass. Okay. And you put randomly this one and these zeros in a completely uniform manner and independent way. And then you keep this thing like this for a given time. And after this given time, you just reshuffle your one and your zeros. And you again make this mass evolution process. And the kind of PDF you obtain are exactly the same. And basically, you have also a dependence on the parameter. And this parameter, which is here gamma, which is the rate at which you are ejecting from an ejecting cell. And so then, for this simple model, one can make some theory. And so basically, one can show that the right tail is algebraic. And one has an estimate of the exponent, which is relating it to the ejection rate from this cell. And one can show that the left tail is indeed super exponential, and that it's something like this. Okay.
So well,
that
it's other way around. Left tail algebraic, right tail.
Ah yes. No. Okay. So the small mass thing is.
Small mass left. Yeah.
Is left is algebraic, and that the large mass, which is the right tail, is a super exponential. So basically, this the main message of this is that the there is no basically that the main mechanism which is responsible for this kind of shape of the PDF is just an ejection from the place which are rotating. Because basically, a model which is having just ejection leads to the same kind of PDFs. And basically, this means that the fluctuation of large mass that you're observing in this coarse grain mass field are not due to the fact that you have attracting places, but just due to the fact that you have several ejecting places which are ejecting to the same place. Okay, that's why it's more than exponential. So I don't know what time it is, how much time I have.
It's 7 minutes after one.
Seven after one? Maybe I should stop. So basically, yes, I will just stop that this problem of mass, just to conclude, this problem of mass ejection and of model for mass dynamics is related to random walks in random environments, where basically what you are looking at is if you are thinking in terms not of mass, but of just a particle motion. Basically, this particle is going from cell to cell, and with a given probability, if it's an ejecting cell, it's moving away from it, and if it's not an ejecting cell, it's just diffusing. Okay, and so this is some settings for random walk in random environments, and which basically mean that it might be possible that a way to characterize this mass distribution is to look at solutions of such a differential PDE, where basically the gammas is the a time-dependent and space-dependent ejection rate of the particles. Okay, so this might be some ideas to get some analytical results on this distribution. Okay, I will stop here.
What's the status of experiments trying to cover testing, scaling?
So the state of experiments is that, so basically the experimentalists I know are usually not measuring volume quantities. So basically what they are doing is that they are either flashing a plane with a laser, and counting the number of particles they have in the neighborhood of this plane, or they are looking at lines. So basically, they just scatter a line and they count the intersection with particles. And to relate this to 3D
is there are holographic measurements.
Yes. Yeah. So I think that some people in Lyon are willing
Jonas did it. Yes.
There are some
doing hologram. You can do 1 cubic meter of a cloud holographic image of every droplet larger than 5 microns. But those data mostly weren't processed yet for this kind of elaborate statistic. But they've seen the statistic is not Poissonian, that's for sure. Which means that they've seen clustering, but never characterized it with that type of.
Yes, and usually the thing which is observed by people is this deviation from Poissonian, which is just some combination of the second order moment and of the first order moment. And basically, I think that, yes, I've never seen data on a systematic way to characterize this deviation as a function of the size of your sampling thing and of the particle size.
Yeah, we did it in 2D.
In 2D,
yeah.
Yes.
On a plane, when you put floaters, then you can study it and it's all visible. And that's what we did a couple of years ago. And we've seen this multifractality and even seen caustics to some extent. But that's still very poor data comparing to this numerical.
In principle, in our laboratory, we have data about thermodensity of particles measured using particle inch velocity techniques. It's possible to use this data for such kind of
things. Interesting to compare because it's a fantastic numerical system. Nothing experimentally yet comparable, I've seen.
Yeah, so as I was saying, some people in Lyon are designing a way to measure really the mass of particles in a given cube. So just put light in a given size of the flow, and they just, according to the diffusion of light, they will be able to have an estimate of the number of particles they have in. So I hope, so I'm discussing with them on these topics, and I hope that they will be able to get experimental things on this coarse grain distribution.
You know, in your study, you ignored the very important thing, in my view, practical application of this stuff, the gradient of temperature, gradient of number density, and so on and so on. So it would be another, in some sense, mean field dynamic, which is important to.
Yes, yes, of course. I mean. But basically, the idea of such studies is to try to highlight some the basic mechanism.
Yeah, but you know,
of course, yes.
A good basic question. For example, meteorological people speak about so-called inch clouds. What is in your picture inch cloud?
I don't know what is an inch cloud.
You know what that means?
No.
They absorb small, how to say, clusters, they are in atmosphere. In clouds, in real cloud, in concentration of particles in small regions. Inch means it's such.
Ah, okay, well, yeah, that,
yeah. So, what in your picture, for example, how to compare all this stuff?
Yeah, it's okay, thanks.
Thank you. Don't forget about soccer today. Okay. Well, the whole picnic, but.